Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and I'm so excited today to be with Richard Whedon as we talk about what he's been working on and thinking about in the world of teaching. Great friend of mine, kind of on the research ed circuit. You're going to get a kick out of this episode. But first, I'm going to talk about our sponsors, which are John Catt Educational and StepLab. John Catt creates and publishes and produces some of the best books in the world around evidence-based teaching. Go check them out by clicking the link in your show notes, and you'll see all of, you know, their catalog and all of their different books. And contact them if you're interested in publishing your own book. They make it really easy for first-time and second-time authors to get their books out there. StepLab is just an amazing infrastructure for schools, and I am the director of StepLab North America, and we help schools get instructional coaching and drop-ins going in a very systematic way based on evidence-informed teaching moves or steps. Contact me, check out the links in the show notes, and I think you won't regret it. Richard, it is so great to have you on the podcast. How you doing, man?
Brilliant. Yeah, great to catch up. I don't think we've seen each other since New York Research Ed last year. We'd be back and forth online, but in person, it was last year over in New York, wasn't it? So yeah, it's great to see you again.
It seems like you've been to the United States quite a bit.
I know, you're interesting. So actually, I lived in the States as a child, only for 3 months. Really interesting experience in Michigan. My dad was an engineer. And actually, my brother is still in America. He's now an American citizen. And so he lives out there. So whenever I come over to do work, I always try and visit him and kill two birds with one stone. But I've really enjoyed being over there. And I think what's interesting is kind of, I miss the cognitive science start in the UK. I had my head down in my job trying to just like get through it. And I missed that kind of journey at the beginning of kind of research ed. And I'm quite enjoying being on that earlier journey that America is finding themselves on and being part of that process of coming over and going, actually, this is what I've learned. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And I've got a few more plans to come out again over the next year to a couple more events. And sure, I'll see you there. But yeah, I'm enjoying my time out there.
I guess it's fun to see something in its infancy, right? We'll see.
No, exactly.
We'll see how much we get done over here, because it's just when you don't have a school system, but just a system of schools, you know, various schools, it's hard to find that cohesion, you know, I feel like.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, obviously the challenges you have, you know, across the whole country, the size of it is more challenging than we had when we started it. You know, that wave in the UK started with some individuals, but then when the government got behind it in the UK and it got put into kind of policy, it made everything easier. So we didn't have some of the challenges that you're facing. But I love coming over and hearing from people and listening to people on your podcast who talk about how excited they are about that, you know, the science of learning and what they're doing in their own schools. And it's nice to hear that, and people really feel like they're making a difference kind of one classroom at a time in the States. And so that's really exciting.
Someone said the line, like, great ideas live and die on the fringes, you know? And it's like, but I feel like it is very alive and well on the fringes, and it's not going to die. It's not going to die on the fringes. It's just everybody's wondering, to what degree is this going to expand, you know? Yeah. One of the things we've been talking about lately, kind of why I wanted to have you on here was around some of the things that you've been trying and testing lately. I feel like, you know, you're one of those people that not only just talks about new techniques, but is able to implement them and then be able to sort of share back a realistic view of that technique, especially if you don't have the culture set up for certain techniques that are kind of making the rounds, or if it's not a school-wide kind of implementation of that technique, how do you do it by yourself? So tell me about some of these. I want to kind of give you the floor to talk about some of the things you've been trying out in classrooms.
Yeah, I think so. What's really important, really, is the context is that, like, I left. So I was in senior leadership and I left last April to write my book that I'm sure we'll talk about afterwards. But in the process of leaving that, I've started doing some substitute teaching kind of day by day. And then I took a long-term placement from September to Christmas. So that's coming towards an end. But I went into a school for kind of 3 days a week for kind of 4 months. So I had my own classes again. And because I was a senior leader, I was only teaching an hour a day, you know, in administration. I had all this other paperwork and things I was doing. So I felt like over the last 6 or 7 years, I've led teaching and learning, but actually I didn't live it out myself because I was not in the classroom. So I was telling others what to do, but not experiencing it. And that's what sometimes some of the criticisms of leadership in schools, they say you're far removed from the classroom because you're not doing it. And one thing that became really clear is that having gone from my comfort at my school, I'd been there several years, to walk into a school cold when nobody knew me, I couldn't rely on some of the things that got me through. And what I mean by that is that because I taught in a school for several years and I taught kids and their brothers and sisters, kids knew that I was a good teacher in inverted commas. And so what would happen is they'd come into the classroom already feeling like I'm going to be successful in this classroom, right? So some of the techniques, I didn't use them. I got away with it, you know, because kids were coming in from day one. They were listening. They were engaged because they knew this. Mr. Whedon's class is where we learn, right? I did have to do some of the techniques that I was actually telling others to kind of do, and I was sharing in the conferences and stuff. And I heard you talk about it in New York. And so when I went into this new school, I walked in. I couldn't rely on my experience. The kids didn't know who I was, so they weren't going to listen. Like, I walked in. They were like, "Who's this guy? He's here for 4 months. It's a maternity cover. Like, I'm not interested." And so I couldn't just stand there and talk, because it became really, really clear the kids weren't going to listen to me. And so I actually showed a StepLab video, actually, to the class and said, "This is what I want this classroom to look like." And it was a video of Pritis Ventura doing call response, check for listening, and those two kind of routines. And so to model to these kids, because this was a school where these two things didn't happen, right? It wasn't already a culture, but I knew walking into a school, if I didn't do these two things, I felt like I was going to be at a massive disadvantage. So I walked in, I showed them a video to like model, this is what call response is. I want you all to respond. This is when we're going to do it. This is the context. If it's always going to be a simple one word answer, you know, it's going to check that you're kind of following through and listen to what I'm saying. And when I started doing it, I got a real buzz that, you know, the kids were really excited, and I'd make a comment like, "Oh, the head of department's down the end of the corridor. I want you to be so loud. I want them to hear you all shout the word cytoplasm or all shout the word mitochondria," whatever it was. So I felt very much instantly this interaction where the kids were kind of like excited to be in the classroom because they got a chance to kind of to give answers. And that was the key thing. I wanted to create this environment where a kid would leave feeling success. And just to give you some context, the school that I'm in, the outcomes, it's a very deprived area and the outcomes aren't very strong. So statistically speaking, you know, over half of those kids leave the school without the qualifications that are kind of the baseline in the UK, right? So these kids are in this system where they don't feel success. And so what I wanted to set up was, you walk in the room, you get a chance really, really early on to shout out an answer 5 or 6 times and feel like you're a successful student. And that was the real, real key for me. So the call response was a real big push for me to get them feeling successful. And people talk about it for other reasons. You know, I know there's, you know, if you're responding and you know you're going to have a chance to speak, you're more likely to be listening and things like that. But for me, it was more about the early success. It was about getting those kids saying things out loud in a classroom. And I know that, you know, my daughter's in high school now, and I spoke to her this morning about it, and she didn't talk at all yesterday in school. You know, she had an entire day in school, and not at any point in the day did she speak in a classroom, you know? And so I didn't want that environment that I was kind of walking into. So call response was the first one. The second thing, the check for listening, I found a bit harder to implement without kind of school-wide. And the kids said it to me that, you know, when I say to the kids, "Well, everyone, hands up." And the first time I get all the hands up and I try and give them praise for kind of doing it. And after a couple of lessons, I'd say the hands up, and they'd go up a bit slower, and kids couldn't remember that I wanted them all to put their hand up and things like that. And when I said to the kids, "Come on, this is something that we do now." And one of the students were like, "Yeah, but we don't do it in any other lesson. Like, we come to you 3 times a week and we do genuinely forget that you expect us to kind of put our hand up all the time." And so that, you know, that is something that I've tried. It has been really, really hard on my own to do. Whereas the call response is one that, because they've enjoyed it so much, that's one that hasn't been hard. I've walked into, you know, every fresh lesson, I've got a new word on the board, 1, 2, 3, boom, everyone says it. And they're all really proud to do it. And I've noticed over the last couple of weeks, as I've got towards Christmas, as I've started to get tired, some of my old routines and habits have come into play. And I noticed a couple of days ago where I was not doing kind of the call response. And then suddenly I cold called a student who normally has the answers. And they went, "I don't know, sir." And I asked another student and they were like, "I don't know, sir." And then I asked a third student. And rather than getting frustrated with the kids in the room going, why does nobody know this? I'm thinking, well, you normally do. Is it something that I'm doing differently? And it was very, very clear that my falling off of the routine, you know, and I know that, you know, I had a coaching model in our last school. We talk about rehearsal. If you're not rehearsing all the time, or if you suddenly get tired and things get in the way and you stop doing them, you can see the difference. And it was a stark contrast. I stood there in this room where I'd moved all these kids on. They were all excited. Assessment was also going really well. And suddenly being in a room where I asked four or five students to answer something that I thought was really simple and none of them gave it to me. And I thought, ah, that's because I wasn't checking the listening. I wasn't call response. I wasn't doing the things that I'd embedded over the last kind of 7 to 8 weeks. So that was a big one for me. When I started it, it was more about the excitement. And now I'm coming several weeks in, and I stopped doing it a little bit. It became really clear just how important it became that the kids almost relied on that call response as a mechanism for which they're engaging, you know, in my classroom. But I've really enjoyed it because, you know, I was teaching an hour or two a day, and now I'm teaching 5 hours a day, 3 days a week. And I absolutely love being in the classroom and getting to try these things out that I've seen on videos, that I've seen other people do. So yeah, that's got the kind of where it is really. And I'm enjoying it. And the thing that I'm doing now, because we have Step Lab in our school, and my small step that I'm working on is paired talk. So that's the kind of the next thing. So I felt like I needed other things in place first. And now my next step is to model that paired talk, because I want those kids, those 20 seconds, 30 seconds, whatever it might be, to become more articulate. So we're moving beyond one word shouting out to kind of giving the depth that I would like on that next step. So that's kind of my next routine that I feel like I'm ready to embed with our class, and we're working towards it. So I'm really enjoying it.
So many questions there. Like the first thing I think about is like how important it is to be grounded in the classroom experience. So you went from leader to teacher, and this has been a question over and over again, because some leaders don't have the path towards going back into the classroom as much as perhaps they have in the UK and in at least teaching one class. And in addition to that, it's like, you know, you take a vacation from teaching, and then you go back into the classroom, and then you inevitably have to return again. And how do you navigate this tension of the majority of my work needs, and all of my work needs to be dedicated to managing adults and parents and the building and the situation, and the fact that it's very easy to lose empathy for the classroom teacher, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know. And everybody says it, and you try to, and you know, and I've always tried to put teachers first. And when I'm sitting in those boardroom meetings and I'm thinking about the decisions that we make at leadership level, I'm always mindful of the teacher, and I try to be. But I don't, you know, the answer to the question is I'm not sure, you know, how, because it was became really clear to me when I walked back in the classroom full time, just how hard it is. You know, it's been several years. You don't get to go to the toilet. You don't get to go to the bathroom. Like you're literally in there all day long with the kids. And when something goes wrong, period two, I'll give you a small example where, as part of leadership, one of my jobs was to go and collect a kid from a classroom who was misbehaving, right? We had an on-call system, a kid's misbehaving, you go and collect them from the classroom and you take them away. Now I'm suddenly in a situation where I'm in the classroom with the child that isn't listening. So I press that button for someone to come and help me. Right now, that feels like an age when you're in that room and you're waiting, and there's this kid in the room who's affecting all of the learning in the classroom, and you're waiting for someone to come in and help you in that situation. It may only be 2 minutes, but that is the worst 2 minutes of your day, to kind of be in that room thinking, I'm helpless in this moment. I've pressed the button. I've tried everything that I've got, positive narration, all of these things. I've gone through all of my toolkit, and whatever, for today, it's not working, and this child needs to be removed. And to feel vulnerable in that moment, and you're reliant on this person to come in. And I've been the person coming in, and you can't always get there instantly. You know, you try to get there as fast as you can. And I've always been mindful of that, but to actually be on the other side of it, and for the first time in a long time, and go, wow, you know, that's tough. Like, it really does put you in a vulnerable situation that you're reliant. You press that button because you can't deal with that situation in that moment. And it's not a criticism of the teacher, because these moments happen, and it is what it is. But it's tough. And I, having been a senior leader, and I've written a book, and you know, it's, you know, I'm supposed to have all this skill set, but ultimately there are times when I need help from somebody else, and it doesn't always come straight away. And I think that has kind of humbled me and reminded me just how important it is as leaders to be there as quick as we can for teachers and to listen to them so that we can, as best as we can, support them. Because I said, we can sit in that ivory tower in that office and think about it, but a 5-period day of lessons back to back with different kids, all those complications is, you know, is tough. And I'm so glad that I've done it. Because I've got this two hats where I do that and I do some consultancy at the same time. I feel like I've got more credibility as a consultant at the moment to be able to go in and talk to schools and go, actually, I do what you're talking about. Not full time, hats off to you, but I am there and I wouldn't give you advice that I wouldn't do myself, because I'm trying to do the same thing, you know. And I think that's been really useful to me and adds credibility to kind of what I'm trying to offer at the moment, because I'm not far removed from it. But to answer your initial question, I don't know how we solve that gap, because you can't have every leaders have roles to do, as you said, all these other jobs that you do, catering, safeguarding, all these things, they're also important. But how do you close the gap is a hard one, other than potentially forcing yourself sabbatical wise to go back in and do stints.
One thing that it doesn't really solve that problem, but it's sort of related. I believe that there's this myth that either all leaders that have become leaders were the best teachers, or they should have been the best teachers. And then that is somehow an important part of the stepping stone of becoming a leader, is that you proved that you were an extremely effective teacher. And of course, we know, like, highly talented people often are ambitious or whatever, so they end up yeah, filling those roles anyway, and they were good teachers. But think about sports. LeBron James has a coach, and that coach was not as good as LeBron James.
Yeah.
And there are many coaches who are failed NBA players, MLB players, who essentially stopped in college. So they were, yeah, they were quite good, better than most of us, but they're not necessarily the top level of all teaching. And so the reason I say all of this is you're talking about your credibility and this and that. Mm-hmm. And I almost wonder if, like, we have this credibility myth or whatever, that your leader needs to have been the greatest teacher, yeah, of all time. I think they need to be the greatest coach of all time,
yeah,
but
yeah,
they don't necessarily need to have been able to be the best teacher of all time. What are your thoughts on how I put that?
No, I agree with you. I mean, like, I'm a, you know, a soccer fan, you know, and you look at, like, Alex Ferguson, Jose Mourinho, and, like, the best managers we've had in the Premier League, they were not top footballers. And I think it's, you know, it is an interesting one, and definitely, and, you know, what I mentioned earlier about not being, when the UK push towards cognitive science happened, the reason I wasn't on that journey was because I was finding that struggle to senior leadership just that, right? I was a, you know, inverted commas, an excellent classroom practitioner, but judged by my peers. I then got to leadership, and the skill set is totally different. And you're right, you can be a very good leader without being an effective classroom practitioner, because it's very, very different. And again, even the idea of empathy, you know, the empathy is an important skill as a leader. You don't have to necessarily have empathy to be a great classroom practitioner. And so they are different. And I think you're right that a lot of the time you get promoted because you're good in the classroom. And we have an interesting route in the UK, which is something that I did for a long time, called an AST. It was an AST, and now it's an SLE. And what they did is they recognized that some teachers didn't want to go into leadership, because that wasn't what they wanted to do. So they created this pathway for teachers to earn more money above the scale, but stay as classroom practitioners. So and so I did that for a while, where my job was not leadership. It was not all that. It was working with teachers every day on that layer. And that happened for a while. It's kind of gone away with the new MAP model, and the structures that we have now are very different. But back kind of 10 years ago, that was a normal thing, where someone would say, I love teaching, and I just want to help teachers get better. And so they'd have a little bit of a reduced timetable, and they would just work within their subjects and their teams. And that's something that was pretty normal. But now with the new MAP structures we have, that's kind of gone away. And this is interesting model where they do have these people, but again, they don't necessarily teach. But yeah, that's been lost in the system. But you are right that it took me a long time. I think it took me longer to become a good leader than it did a good teacher. Like, I feel like teaching was natural, and I got it, and I understood, and I there were certain things, skill sets that I had, I'd already brought to it. I used to be a chef in a kitchen through university, and I always when the dishes come in and you've got all these things happening at the same time, you've got to put this food on and this food and this food, and you've got all these things happening at the same time. When I first walked into a classroom, I felt like it was a kitchen. You know, you've got these 30 kids in the room and you've got all these kids popping off for different reasons. And I actually feel in some ways working in a kitchen suited gave me more skill sets than my degree did when it came to orchestrating a classroom, right? And so that prior experience of working in a in that environment with all these different people prepared me to go into the classroom. But actually, like, what prepared me to become a leader was almost like failing at it. It was almost like I didn't do very well, and I had to go away and do more reading. And it's better now, but back then there was no educational books on leadership. They were outside of things. So my first leadership book I ever read was Steve Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. But that was 2 or 3 years into my leadership experience, where I was talking to my father and saying I'm struggling, and he was like, "Read this book. It helps you understand habits." And so yeah, it was almost after I made the mistake that I was searching for it. But you're right, that because the transition could be too fast. People go from teachers to leaders almost at this rapid pace, and then you'll find it really, really difficult. And yeah, there are programs that we have in the UK to solve that. There's national qualifications that you can do. I'm now doing my national qualification for headship at the moment. So it's a 2-year program that I do in the evenings, because I don't, if I became a head, and I'm not sure I want to be, but if I did, then the program that's happened before I've done it, whereas I know in the past, I've become a leader before I've done the program. So I'm trying to do it the right way. So I don't want to get to the top in a sense and kind of fail. So there are ways of slowing it down, but it's really hard, especially in challenging schools. They promote you really fast because they want to keep you. You know, they want good practitioners in the school, and you get to uncomfortable positions and don't have the skills to kind of solve it. And hopefully a lot of the time, and I was lucky in my early career, that I think when you are a good practitioner and people recognize it, they give you more grace when you maybe make mistakes as a leader. What I found really hard is when I moved from London, where I grew up as a teacher and moved up through the ladder, I moved to Liverpool where nobody knew me and walked into a new school. And that was really, really hard. Like walking into a school I'd never been in a different city. They didn't know who I was. They didn't know what I cared about. They didn't know I was a good teacher. They knew nothing. And that, nothing prepared me for that, to walk into a new school at assistant and senior leadership level, and thinking everyone's going to listen to me just because I am who I am. And it kind of didn't work. And that was really challenging.
What do you think about like the internal versus like external hire when it comes to all this? Because what ends up happening is like you hire within because you know that person better to deal with the person you know than like, you know, roll the dice on someone else. But then you get this sort of all this baggage that comes from the relationships with that person. And what, why did you do Richard and why not me? And like, I thought I was on track to be promoted and all this stuff. And it almost is cleaner in a sense to like bring someone in externally and be like, hey, they have a great reputation that you can't possibly check in on, you know? I know.
Definitely. So it's interesting. So when I moved, so obviously I was an internal hire all the way through in my school in London. And then when I moved up north, what was interesting, the head teacher was external, but his entire leadership team had worked at that school for their entire lives. And so I came in as the first person in that leadership team that was new. And the second person, there was one other person actually, sorry. But yeah, I felt that was extremely important. And especially because in London, people tend to move more often because for career-wise, you move quite quick. In Liverpool, where I was, everyone had been there their whole lives. And that itself creates a secondary problem, not only with the promoting internally people, but you're not outward facing. And so I think that when you always hire with, and I know I've applied for jobs in the past and not got them and seen internal candidates got them and thought, you know, thought to myself, I'm sure my CV is better than theirs. I'm sure I could add value, you know, that they don't have. But I get why people go internally. It feels safer. It's definitely a confirmation bias when it comes to promoting internally. But I suppose it's that nervousness at senior leadership level of not wanting to rock the boat by taking someone you don't know. You know, you have 48 hours to make a decision. You see them in a couple of situations. At that level, you can't make a mistake. So it's easier to go with the person that you know, that you trust, than it is to go with an outsider. Even if the outsider looks like they're going to bring some qualities, it is a scared factor. And if I was in that situation, as you know, I've done it at middle leadership level. I've brought in heads of science and lower level things from outside. But if I was a head teacher, I think I'd have to think very carefully about that decision making, because it's a fine balance isn't it? You can't have everyone external. You can't have everyone internal. I think you need that mix of both. Otherwise, you're going to struggle.
I think teaching, to quote my friend Robert Pondicio, it's sort of become a job that's beyond mere mortals, right? Mm-hmm. And you have, I like to say there are sort of five things that teachers all do. They deliver instruction, they design instructional sequences, they motivate and manage behavior, they deal with parents, and they deal with administrative tasks, yeah. Right? And it's sort of like, if we can take the specs here of these five and either completely eliminate them, like I'll give like an example no one likes, but it's true. Like, we need teachers to deliver instruction, but we don't need them to design instruction. So why don't we design it for them and just have them just deliver it, right? And so you can play with that model a bit. And so, having presented that to you and you, in your role right now, what are the things you wish would just be taken off your plate? Yeah. You know what I mean?
So I think, so we have that in the UK system because of the MAP model. And I'll give a bit more context to it for, you know, the American kind of the main audience. So like 10, 12 years ago or so, this new structure came in place where schools were not always improving. So what they wanted to do was take schools that were really, really successful and say, you now have the right to take on other schools because you have a model that works. And so this school can buy into your system and didn't have to be geographically local. It could be anywhere across the country. And so as that has kind of cropped up, you've got these schools that are kind of, you know, really successful. And one of the roles within them is what that's allowed schools to do is say, right, okay, who is the best science teacher at understanding the curriculum? Like, let's take them off teaching and let's make them the curriculum design person for our trust. So we've got these 12 schools across the country. You're going to write everything. And then that takes away the burden from the teacher. It's an interesting argument because having not worked in a Motley Academy Trust, I'm currently in one. And there's a downside to it about a link to a lack of autonomy. So I'm now in a school where there's this one person I've never met before who's wrote the lessons that I have to deliver. I don't agree with every decision that has been made. I would do things differently, but I don't have the autonomy to make those decisions anymore. So it's a fine line either way. You could take away a decision, but does that then take away the autonomy for the teacher to want to make their own decisions in the classroom? Do they then get frustrated? They go, I don't want to do X, I want to do Y instead. You know, it's a tough one. And what's good about the UK is there's two systems. If you want to work in a multi-academy trust, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. There are schools that are single schools where you make your own decisions all the time. And so what's great about the choice in the UK is, as a teacher, if you're thinking, well, I don't care about making my own decision. I don't matter what lesson goes first and what lesson goes second. It's not a big deal for me. I want to reduce the burden of that. I'm going to go and work in a multi-academy trust where that's done for me. Well, if you're at the point of view where you go, actually, I'm really confident in my curriculum. I've been teaching 25 years. I don't want someone else to tell me how to do it. I've got to go and work in school X instead. And so what that's allowed in the UK, and what's really interesting when you look at the models, is that there's no clear-cut argument that what the mat is better than the standalone school. It's just that for certain individuals, we have choice. And so individuals can go and make those choices, and they both work for the systems that they're in. And so that's what we have in the UK. And, you know, we've talked a lot, and you have on your podcast, and in America when I come over, a lot about the fact the UK has made strides in PISA tests and scores and so on. And that is part of that. Is that teachers get to work in the type of school that works for them. And I think you don't have to, but you can. And I think that's what's important.
That what you just said is so underrated in my view. We here do too. We have a teacher shortage, but what that the other side of that is that means that you are extremely demand. You're in demand in this country, yeah. Everywhere you go. And so when I hear teachers say that I feel locked into this job, that I have to do it this way of doing things, because I'm on the explicit instruction, high standards of behavior. And I go, yeah. I just want to say, move, walk with your feet. But the problem, of course, occurs is that if you don't have that choice around you, if everything is the same piece of junk, then it's like, you're right, you are trapped, even though you can't really move because it's just a roll of the dice if you tried to move, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
You've been writing a new book, Learning Habits. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
What's the big idea behind it? And what do you hope teachers will take away from it?
Kind of where this came from is that almost 2 years ago now, is that I identified a problem in our school that if you talk about instructional practice and what good teaching looks like, I was confident. I'd been leading teaching and learning for several years in our school. You know, whether you look at Rosenshine or Lamarve or whatever you want, you know, where you're taking it from, the teaching quality was really good in our school. We were really happy with what teachers were doing in the classroom. You know, our external body, Ofsted, the UK, that comes in and judges schools, they came in and judged the teaching to be really, really good. And so we were happy with that. But what we weren't happy with is that the outcomes were still not as strong as we thought they could be. You know, there were students in our school that were leaving school that were doing okay, but not as well as we wanted. And when I kind of interviewed them when they left to kind of find out what went wrong, what became really clear to me is that the kids were getting a great experience in the classroom. But when they left the classroom, the decisions that they were making were poor. And so we were making decisions in the classroom to help learning happen. But when kids went home, they were making poor choices that were not supporting the development of learning. And I felt like learning was being done to them as opposed to learning being done with them. And they didn't, you know, and so I started off on this premise that, like, why aren't we letting kids in on the secret of cognitive science? Like, there's enough evidence there now that we know that this works. Like, why aren't we telling kids about it explicitly? And we've done one-off assemblies. We did an assembly where we'd say, space retrieval works, go and do it. Go and do retrieval practice and things. But even though we told them to do it, kids were not doing it. And so that's where I started kind of 2 years ago. And I did a lot of reading and I couldn't find the answers. The closest I got were Danny Williams' book about why students don't like school, talking in terms of, like, why kids don't make good decisions. I actually went down to research head in London, and Sarin Cottinghat, who I think now is at StepLab with you guys, I watched the talk about adaptive expertise and how does teachers become experts. And what dawned on me, which is really obvious now, in order to become an expert, you have to have a deep knowledge of the thing that you're trying to become an expert of, right? And so what dawned on me with the students is that how can students become expert learners if they don't know what learning is? If no one has explicitly taught them the idea of learning. And so that's where this stemmed from. It stemmed from, okay, I want kids to be expert learners. So how do we create a framework for them to do that? How do we actually deliver a sequence of lessons, case studies, scenarios, things that the kids could engage with? So at the end of a series or end of a year or 2 years, whatever it might be, they make better decisions. And at the start of the book, I talk about students sitting at university. And I say that the child is sitting in a university lecture and they're making notes and they suddenly realize they've got cognitive overload. They realize they're in the lecture and they go, you know what? There's too much new information coming at me. I need to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to change tack now. And instead of writing down everything like possibly can, I'm going to listen really carefully and just hear every new word that comes from the lecture that I don't understand. I'm going to write that down and nothing else because everything else is too much for me in this moment. The student then goes away from the lecture. They sit back in the halls and they say, right, now my next role is to connect my knowledge that I already have in my pre-existing schema to all this new knowledge that my lecturer has just told me that I don't understand. So they sit there, they make connections, they make mind maps, whatever it might be. And then the student realizes just because I've made a mind map doesn't mean that in 2 weeks I'm going to remember this information. So now I'm going to turn it into flashcards. I'm going to practice every day for the next 2 weeks, right? And then after 2 weeks, they walk into another lecture and they're in a better place. Now, I don't think, I'm fairly confident that there aren't many schools anywhere where they can put their hand up and say, we are preparing our students to walk into a lecture at university and think like that. And so that's what my goal was. My goal was, not only do we get kids good grades, but how do we get, we know what expert learning looks like. So why aren't we creating expert learners? And so that was my lofty goal. And the same way in which StepLab talks about adaptive expertise teachers. How do we make teachers better teachers? We close the knowing doing gap, right? We shine a light on their decision making and say, this is the decision you made in the moment. Tell me why you made it. This is why it doesn't work. This is what's better. And so I wanted the same thing for students. So like the goal in the book is to, there are stories. The book is for the teachers to read and for parents to read. And then within the book, there are experiments and stories the child would read. And then there are reflective questions that you would unpick with the child afterwards. So to give you the context of an example, one of the experiments I talk about is Murdoch's free recall experiment. It's 1962. So you give the kids the task, which is every second for 15 seconds, they get a word. So you actually get the kids to experience the real experiment that we now understand and helps us make better teaching decisions. So you give the kids a word every second, 15 words, cat, house, dog, whatever they are. And at the end of 15 seconds, you just tell them which one can you remember, right? And just like the original results, kids remember the first two or three words and they remember the last two or three words. And what's really key with this is that there's a different reason for remembering the first three and the last three. The first three is because they practice them over and over again. Because when you ask kids to remember the list, what they're normally doing in their head, they're going cat, dog, house, car, cat, dog, house. And repeating the first one multiple times, right? So they practice the word cat. They're never forgetting the word cat. It's been said over and over again in their head. The stuff towards the end is recency effect. It's still in their working memory, right? The most recent word was just said, so they're remembering that. What's really, really cool about the original experiment, and when you do it with kids, the same outcome comes out today, and this is 50 years old. You ask the kids to take a number above 150 and count back in threes. So they'll go 172, 169, 166, and so on. What suddenly happens then when you say to the students, right, what were the words again you were asked to remember? They still remember the first three words, but they forget the last three. And what to unpick them with the kids is, right, the reason you remember the first three is because rehearsal means that it's moved to your long-term memory. Right? Rehearsal means you've practiced it enough that it's moved away from this other place. The last three words are in your working memory. And because you've now done a complex calculation, you've had cognitive overload, and those last three words have suddenly disappeared. And so actually the kids experiencing in real time cognitive overload, this idea that rehearsal has remembered something, gives them the power to go, I understand this. I understand why my teacher has asked me to do X and why they're not, and why this works in the classroom. And so the goal of the first half of the book is for the kids to experience the last 70 years of cognitive science in a way that makes sense to them.
That just blew my mind for a second. All right, let's talk about that for a second. Okay, wait. You essentially explained the almost all of memory and instruction with just that thing right there.
Yeah.
You went, the thing that you practiced the most, that's the thing that you remembered. The thing that you just did, you think you know it because you can recognize it easily, but it's not in your long-term memory. And all that stuff in the middle, why don't you remember it? Well, cognitive load theory, right? Essentially, you had too much in the first place. And so, you know, in cognitive load theory, why is long-term memory your superpower? Because the things that you remember enable you to do stuff. That's the first part. Why do we always, you know, if you sort of unites kind of cognitive load theory and desirable difficulties in exactly. just one explanation.
And that's where we go next. We go to desirable difficulties, talk about that.
Right.
One kind of phrase I use a lot in the book is Daniel Willingham's, my favorite, is that memory is the residue of thought. And so then what we move on to is actually this idea of deep thinking is really, really important. And there's lots of various experiments, but my favorite one is the one where you get kids to read two stories. You tell the students, half of you are a burglar and half of you are a home buyer. And I'm going to give you a story to read, and this story is in the book. And you're thinking of the story as someone that's going to burgle this house, right? And at the end of the task, you say to the students, "What's the first five words that come to your heads?" And the words that the burglar remembers are totally different to the words that the home buyer remembers. And this is really key because, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, poor teaching that we did kind of 15 years ago. My worst lesson ever was when I made ice cream in the classroom. The goal was to teach solids, liquids, and gases, right? And I actually, to prove how bad this is, that kind of 12 years later, a young trainee teacher walked into my school and said, sir, I'm back, I've become a teacher. I loved your lesson that you taught. It inspired me to become a teacher, which was great from that point of view. I said, what was the lesson? He said, it was the ice cream lesson. I loved it. I said, what did you learn? He went, how to make ice cream, you know? I said, that idea. And so this idea of making kids clear, if you're a burglar, you're going to remember the parts of the house that you were thinking about the most. And so not only do we want you to rehearse, but actually if you're sitting in a classroom and you're not thinking deeply about the key components of the lesson, you are less likely to remember them, you know, later. And so getting kids to experience firsthand poor decision making, I was thinking about the wrong thing. And, you know, I talk in the book about choral questioning and how important it is, and strategies that we have used to increase participation. But ultimately, the kid has a role to play in the classroom. Because if you're teaching, I was teaching the other week about slave trade. So I was talking about slave trade, and we're talking about vitamin C deficiency, right? Now, if you've got a kid in a classroom and they're thinking, I went on a boat last week. Oh, I went on holiday to Greece and I was on a boat. And that's what they're thinking about in your lesson. Even though you've tried to talk about the slave trade, a kid suddenly has a visual memory of a trip they took to Greece, you know, and whatever you said is out the window. So however much we can try to increase participation, there is a role that the child has to play in the classroom and they have to stay on task. But in order to increase the likelihood of that happening, they have to understand why it's so important to them. And so that was the starting point of my book. It's like, let's give kids the tools, but not, you know, to understand why it's so important they make good decisions. And that's kind of where I started with it. And kind of, it's called Learning Habits, because the first part, half of the book, is about teaching kids how to learn. But the second half of the book is about habits, because it became increasingly clear, even when you tell kids to make good decisions, their lives, you know, talk about desirable difficulties, it's a terrible name, because they're not desirable at all. You know, space retrieval, interleaving are by nature challenging, right? So kids don't want to do them. When kids go home, they want to make a mind map and make it look pretty. And they want to add colors because it makes them feel good about themselves, right? It gives them instant gratification. And so even when you say to kids, go and do X, and they go, I know X is now a better option. After they've had a hard day in school and they're tired, they're not always going to do the thing that you want, because they make poor decisions when they're tired. And one of the studies I found was really interesting, in Kahneman, Fast Thinking, Slow Thinking. There's a about judges, and there was a study done about parole hearings, and they looked to see about the decisions that judges were making before and after lunch. And it turns out that judges make much worse decisions when they're hungry compared to afterwards. Like, you're more likely to get sent back to prison or jail if a judge makes a decision at 11 a.m. compared to 1 p.m. in the afternoon. So I'm thinking to myself, if judges make poor decisions when they're hungry, what do we expect of our kids in our schools, right? And so it's not as simple as just saying, okay, go and make better decisions now. The second half of the book is teaching kids to take ownership of their decisions by making new habits. And looking at behavioral psychology and saying, I want to make a better decision. How do I put habits in place to make it more likely for me to do it? Because it's not natural for me to want to engage with desirable difficulties. So learning is the first half. Habit formation is the second half of the book.
Perfect. We're almost out of time. I guess I wanted to close down on your thoughts on this, which is that what's the difference between learning habits as a book and a framework and an approach. And I guess what some people be worried about, which would be like kind of more fuzzy skills, you know, generic sort of learning skills. Yeah. Like, how do you, I know that what this is going to do is it's going to squeeze every ounce of juice out of all students. It's going to make them, focused and hard workers. Compare that to, like, you know, I don't know, some of the more woo-woo stuff that's out there around this, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's the tricky thing, actually, that schools have been burnt with soft skills before. This idea that, you know, let's teach kids these soft skills. And so that's been kind of the biggest push for me, actually, is to get the message out there. That's not what this is. This is not fuzzy. This is not learning styles. This is not, I prefer to watch a PowerPoint than do this. This is grounded in cognitive science. This is what we use to become better classroom practitioners applied to kind of students. So there isn't, every study that I put in the book is based on kind of real research and is then applied to kids, and then they can apply it. So yeah, one thing that we know is Malcolm Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours to become an expert at anything. And our kids are in school for like 14,000 hours between the age of kind of 5 and 18. So my argument isn't just like teach this in a week. This is that over the space of the age of 5 to 18, if we embed these over a long period of time, can we go from here to becoming an expert learner at 18 after college or university? The answer is yes. So this isn't a, let's just do a 4-week course for 10-year-olds and solve this. This is schools looking at all of these things, working with parents, working at home and going through them and saying, how can we take this framework over 4 to 5 years, build it slowly, and so that our kids leave with better decisions? And so, yeah, that's my biggest barrier, really, to getting the message out there, which is kind of why I'm doing podcasts, because schools have been burnt with going, oh, this is a soft skill. We're going to get kids to be better at X or Y. But yeah, this is different. This is not that. There's no fuzziness in there. It's all based on research. And so that's what I would say in kind of closing.
Yeah. And I think also with the ultimate goal, like you started with, How do we get them to have better results, as
Yes.
opposed to like, how do we turn them into lifelong learners? Well, we are.
Yeah.
It's always that, isn't it? It's always the goals are the same, but the way you get there is dramatically different. And also some of
Yeah.
our values in school results matter and so on is different, I think, than the other side of things.
Yeah, I always say there's one thing that Carl Hendrick talks about. The argument for explicit instruction is that over kind of inquiry-based learning is you wouldn't let a kid teach themselves to drive a car, right? My argument is the same premise for developing independence. We can't let kids develop independence by themselves, right? They can't guesswork how to become an expert learner. You have to explicitly teach them how to be an expert learner. And this book provides the teacher or the school with the framework to do that.
I love it. I think it's perfect time for people to consider the other side of the coin in terms of the learner, and because a lot of us have got the teaching part right. Get in touch with Richard and talk to him about the progress on all his thinking, because he's got all these great ideas he shared with us today. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. I love, 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 love doing these podcasts, and I'm always sort of all over the place with my thinking. So if you want to ever get in touch with me and suggest a guest or suggest the topic, I'm always interested in expanding what we talk about on this show. Please give it a 5-star rating and so on and so forth. Have a great day, everyone.